Our fourth case for this morning is Yang v. Holder, 1338-49.
Mr. Zhang. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Deng Haiyi, I represent the petitioner in this case. Credibility is the most important issue in a removal proceeding, and in this case, the immigration judge found the petitioner credible in every single aspect.
But can I ask you a factual question? The record indicates that on April 30 of last year, 2013, the Board of Immigration Appeals remanded Mr. Yang's new I-130 proceeding, the denial, back to the district director because of the error in acknowledging whether he had responded or not. Are those proceedings still ongoing, or has there been any decision?
It's still pending, and the couple went for an interview on May 15th this year, just last month, and that decision is still pending as we speak today, as of yesterday when I checked before I come here.
Okay, so my follow-up question, it's my understanding, although I can ask the government this question as well, that these are sufficiently distinct paths that even if Mr. Yang were removed as a result of this case, if the I-130 receives favorable treatment and he then gets the immediate relative visa, he would be able to come back to the United States lawfully.
Actually, that's no. This removal proceeding has to be remain open for him to be eligible to adjust the status to permanent residence, even if after the I-130 was approved.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, if he loses this proceeding and he is ultimately removed to China, and, you know, let's just assume that happens.
Yes.
There he is in China. But the I-130 proceeding is an independent proceeding, and if there's a favorable finding for him that the second marriage, the Preston marriage, was indeed a bona fide marriage, as his supporting materials assert, then that wouldn't be a reason to deny the I-130 filed by Feng Li, right? You know, and then once you get that processed, I know there are other things. You've got to wait for a visa and so on. But in principle, even though he would be in China, he would be able, if all worked out favorably for him, to come back?
Assuming if the I-130 is filed by the current spouse is approved today and he's deported back to China tomorrow, he will not be able to come back until 10 years later because he's subject to the 10-year bar for unlawful presence.
Even if the I-130 were favorably.
He wouldn't be back. For what reason did you say?
The 10-year bar,
yeah, for the unlawful presence in the U.S.
So because of his unlawful presence, he would have to wait in China for 10 years.
For 10 years, that's correct.
And is that waivable by the Secretary of Homeland Security or the Attorney General?
It's waivable in theory, but in practice it's extremely hard. Mm-hmm. Because the separation of family members, they do not consider, are not considered extreme hardship. So the U.S. spouse had to suffer like either mental or physical illness, severe illness for the non-citizen spouse to take care of her or him.
So there's some extraordinary showing that's necessary in order to get a waiver of the 10-year bar.
Yes, much, much harder.
Was there documentary proof in the record, like a FedEx receipt, something like that, that Mr. Yang's UCCIS response was delivered to the immigration court?
Yes, it was delivered, signed by USCIS employee, but somehow they misplaced that response, so they started fought the petitioner for this error.
But there was actually proof in the record that it was delivered.
Exactly, yes. It was delivered and signed. That's why the BIA remanded the case to begin with.
Yeah, there was a signed receipt from DHS, I believe.
That's correct.
Yeah,
somehow that signed package did not go to his file. And when the interviewing officer did not receive that in time, so he or she denied the case.
That's actually your strongest argument for a continuance, because had they received had they kept it straight, you know, if they knew they received it, they did receive it, but if they'd put it in the right place and adjudicated it, then there's at least a chance they would have revisited the conclusion about the Preston marriage.
That's correct.
And you know, had that been a favorable consideration, maybe something different would have happened. But another aspect of this case is confusing to me. I don't understand why Mr. Yang didn't comply with these fingerprinting, these biometric requirements, even though it seems to me absurd for the government to ask you to submit fingerprints every 3 months or whatever it is.
Yep.
But if that's the requirement, then that's the requirement. It's not that hard to get your fingerprints taken.
It sounds very easy to get the fingerprints taken, but I think, in fact, in this case, his fingerprints was taken at least twice. Once for the 589, the asylum application, the other for the immigration application.
Right, I know. And then, so I don't know why they needed even more fingerprints, but they said they did, and he didn't submit.
And the thing is, he made the good faith effort through his then counsel. Like the counsel, I believe he testified, he spoke in court. He made it like four attempts.
So did he have to do it at a... I don't understand why it's so hard. People get their fingerprints taken every day for background checks, for this and that. There are half a dozen places on Jackson Street that'll do it for you. So did he have to go to,
from New York to Chicago?
Was there only one designated place in the United States he could get this done?
There are like almost every city has one list, like application center to do the fingerprints.
So you have to actually go to a DHS facility to get your fingerprints taken?
At that time, that was the rule. I believe like in the past several months, I think the DHS has changed that policy, the fingerprint requirement. Well, now you don't have to physically be printed again.
Is there an Is it expensive?
No, that's free.
It's free.
Mm-hmm. It's free. So it's not like Mr. Yang did not want his fingerprints to be taken. He had no criminal record in the U.S. In fact, at one of the merits hearing, his fingerprints was current and clear few days before the merits hearing. It's not like that he committed some crime after the merits hearing. So I don't know. So common sense approach, people's fingerprints, they don't expire, but they keep taking it.
Right. I mean, unless you thought some imposter was showing up saying that he was Mr. Yang, I don't know what all these new fingerprints are doing. Because you could run a check on the same fingerprints as often as you wanted.
I believe that's the current practice, but I think she has more knowledge on this point.
Okay. Well, you're in your rebuttal time if you would like to save a little bit.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Cohen.
May it please the Court, Brianne Cohen on behalf of the United States Attorney General.
I have the very same question that Judge Wood has. I'd appreciate you explaining to me why asylum applicants needed to be reprinted every time there's a continuance, and sometimes four or five times. I mean, their fingerprints don't change.
Right, the fingerprints don't change. However, there are important reasons for why an applicant would have to come back. First of all, at the time of this hearing, that was sort of what set the action in motion to rerun a security check. So that's DHS's sort of administrative way of engaging those checks. And I would just also point out that
that's a silly reason, though. I mean, you could rerun the security check. I mean, you know, I have global entry, you know, at the airport, and I just go and I put my fingerprints down on the little machine there at the point of entry, and they're sitting there in some database, and it knows that it's me as soon as it reads. You know, I don't have to go get my fingerprints retaken every year.
And certainly fingerprints don't change, but because the technology is changing all the time, it's completely reasonable for DHS to say within a 1 year to 15-month period, we may need you to come in and comply with the new requirements.
They're not changing that quickly.
You know, I mean, is it really your argument that a person with an otherwise airtight asylum application who clearly warrants protection in this country could be denied asylum solely because she fails to be fingerprinted for the fourth time within 2 weeks of the master calendar hearing while allowing for 4 months of processing of a security check or whatever hoops the immigration judge sets up? Is that really your argument?
Well, and this court in New Mazurique did address that concern, and the regulations require applicants to comply with certain procedural requirements, and there's nothing unreasonable in this case about requiring an applicant to apply. And so perhaps the bigger issue is...
Well, there's everything unreasonable in every case about this rule. I mean, look, the FBI manages to deal quite well with fingerprints from
once
a very long period of time when they have one set of them. So I really think this policy seriously needs reexamining for a person such as Mr. Yang, who has been forthcoming, who's had his fingerprints taken a couple of times, no reason to think he's, you know, some imposter trying to stand in for Mr. Yang or whatever other weird scenarios you're thinking of.
Well, I would just first point out that the policy does occasionally change and that DHS does relook at these policies and whether or not they're reasonable. And I think the last time was, I think it was recent as 2011. I'm not intimately familiar with those procedures. But the other thing I would point out is the number of assurances in this case that Mr. Yang did have ample opportunity and was given ample notice of the requirements.
Now, is it true that he has only one? He can't just go get his fingerprints taken at the local police station. He's got to go only to some DHS facility?
I believe at the time that was true. Certain processing centers were designated for this.
That's just a logjam waiting to happen. You would think, you certainly want a reputable entity doing it, but there are all kinds of places. Again, the local police fingerprint people constantly.
And again, I think those procedures have changed, but at the relevant time, it was required that they go to an applicant application center. I should also point out that at the time of his proceedings, he was, at least on one occasion, and once for the asylum application, he was able to comply with the requirements, and second, with the adjustment application. And so it did not seem that it was too difficult a task for Mr. Yang to comply with these, as he had done so in the past.
So what worries me about this case, beyond the absurdity of the fingerprint rule, which does worry me, it is certainly not the asylum. That's beyond the one-year bar. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I'm not worried about CAT either. I'm worried about the denial of the continuance. Given his somewhat unusual situation of the mislaying of his response and these parallel tracks that are going on, this isn't somebody who just says, I have some hypothetical hope that someday somebody will give me a work visa or somebody will do this. He really was victimized by mismanagement within the U.S. government.
Well, there certainly is evidence that the, as Mr. Zhang pointed out, that the evidence was received and not considered by the district director. And that is exactly
what
precisely...
Which is why BIA sent it back to the district
exactly.
director. So we have excellent evidence of that. That was BIA's own conclusion, your client.
Yes, but I should point out that, again, this is strictly because of that procedural error and that the board, in this case, not in the remanded I-130 proceeding, but pointed out that given the ultimate unlikelihood that Mr. Yang will be eligible to adjust and will be approved for the visa because of the outstanding fraudulent marriage finding.
But see, that was what this was all about. I don't know why the IJ, in ruling on the continuance, shouldn't have been obliged to look at the evidence that he properly proffered, but that the government erroneously misplaced. There's actually some pretty good evidence in there. He's got affidavits from his stepdaughter. He's got a very long marriage. He's got reasons why you can see there might have been a divorce. There were money issues in the marriage. This is, and he actually has an explanation for why they lived in different cities. He's looking for work. So looking at that information, it seems to me, would be necessary for an intelligent decision. Because, of course, if the fraudulent marriage finding goes away, this whole proceeding looks different.
Mm-hmm.
You would agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. But I think that the board did look at that and said that his ultimate eligibility for adjustment of status was unlikely. And there are some important sort of procedural and factual implications in this case. First of all,
Where did the board... Can you direct me to where exactly the board said that when it remanded?
In the board's remand, which is in the administrative record at page 108, oh, no, I'm sorry, excuse me. In the agency decision before review, the board says on the second and third page of its decision, the final pages of its decision, that the visa petition remains denied and he remains ineligible for adjustment status at this time. They do say that they make no decision on the merits because that decision does lie within the purview of the district director, but they talk about sort of his... he was not prima facie eligible to adjust.
But I don't see any comment in that section. He's submitting supporting documentation. The visa it remains denied. Well, that's true. There's been no ruling. But I don't see any kind of merits-related comment from the board other than just at the, an accurate description of the procedural posture of the case. And so it's not clear to me that the board looked at that evidence either. They're saying is if you've misplaced the man's entire packet of evidence, you've got to send it back and take a look at it, district director.
That's in the remand for the I-130. However, in the denial of the continuance that's before the court now, they do talk about his prima facie eligibility for relief. And that's very critical in this case because the denial of the I-130 relates to the I-130 that is from his third wife, his current wife. The outstanding first fraudulent marriage challenge remains.
I understand that, but that's what he's trying to address in this new packet of material. And I agree with you that he's not in a situation of prima facie eligibility because this outstanding factual dispute remains. So that, without a doubt, but his likelihood of success on the merits depends on the quality of the evidence that he submitted.
And that was mismanaged.
And that was what was mismanaged. And so I'm concerned that neither the board nor the IJ seems to have looked at that in assessing the appropriateness of a continuance.
Well, I think that the board and the IJ did. And certainly
I don't see that signs of that. I mean, you may have faith in them. I'm glad you do. They're your client. But they need to give up. They throw us a bone. Show us where you did that.
Well, I think that, again, the discussion of the prima facie eligibility for adjustment status.
But that doesn't mean anything to me. That just means there's an issue outstanding. You haven't cleared this hurdle yet, but it doesn't say anything about the actual merits of that issue. It's an accurate statement as far as it goes, but it doesn't tell me they looked at anything.
But I think in this case where you have such strong evidence, that keep in mind that this,
I don't
the
think
first
the evidence is all that strong.
No, that's exactly
when I looked at his packet of materials that he was trying to submit.
We see a lot of these. That looks pretty good.
But the thing that in this case, the original visa petition, this goes back to 2002. His first U.S. citizen wife, Ms. Preston, actually withdrew that
Well, they were and they not getting along.
Well, they also investigated and found that the couple was never living together.
And he has an explanation for that. He says he was living in other cities. He was trying to find work. He was, the stepdaughter testifies.
Friends.
The sincerity of the marriage, friends. I mean, there's evidence. There's actual evidence in this case.
Well, the other procedural factors I think that the board relied on that are evident here is the lapse in time. We're talking about between 2002 and 2011, and the fact that this case had been continued multiple times. If Mr. Yang had a challenge to the fraudulent marriage finding from 2002, he could have done so throughout the entire proceedings. He wasn't
He wouldn't have had reason to do that until the new I-130 based on the new wife is filed.
I respectfully disagree because the first visa petition was denied in 2002 and his first application for adjustment of status was denied in 2003 based on that fraudulent marriage finding. So at that time, he was on notice that there was an outstanding fraudulent marriage finding against him, which he failed to challenge in any way. I see them.
If I may change the subject a bit, this is fundamentally a Falun Gong case, I believe. And we all know the hostility of the Chinese government to that organization. It's been widely reported in the press. Was there a State Department analysis of that situation in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or do you have to show some sort of physical aspect to the persecution in order to prove persecution?
Well, in this case, this is a
hostility, not enough.
There was the 2007 State Department report, so the agency did consider that Falun Gong practitioners may be persecuted in China, and this court's case law is instructive on that. However, because this is a withholding of removal case because of the asylum bar, petitioner was required to show a clear probability, and the scant evidence that he presented that the government is really interested in him, simply an isolated, generic conversation with his father and the police, without more was insufficient to make that showing. And
well, they didn't beat him up or lock him up or anything of that sort. But what is required to show persecution in the case of a Falun Gong situation?
Well, I will point out, just to clarify, he was arrested on one occasion, but this was years ago in 1997.
And slapped.
And he was slapped and detained for less than
A cell. And oh, God.
Yes, and the agency considered this claim. Unfortunately, the standard of past persecution is extremely high, and the board reasonably found that it did not constitute past persecution, and there's nothing in the evidence that compels a contrary conclusion. And with regard to the well-founded fear, the clear probability, there was simply no evidence that the Chinese government would have any awareness of his practice in the United States. And again, I would point this...
But he said he has evidence. Actually, I wouldn't say there's no evidence. Yeah. He said he participated in demonstrations in front of the UN and in New York, and that he has practiced publicly in the United States as well as privately.
But that is speculative evidence. The agency properly noted that he doesn't have anything than his own speculation that the Chinese government was somehow aware of those protests.
You don't think the Chinese government keeps track of who's demonstrating against it in New York City?
In front of the UN.
But in a group of 20 to 30 practitioners, for him to show that perhaps, testimony from other participants, something a little more concrete. And I would point this court to its decision in Chen, where...
What would be concrete? Photographs?
Something
that he could get from the Chinese government? What would be concrete?
Well, for example, in Q, this court found that where the government had actually visited the petitioner's family and found summonses had been left for his arrest, then that would be direct evidence, and this court found that was good evidence.
His father has been visited by the police in China.
But petitioner admitted there was no mention of Falun Gong. It was a very generic and isolated incident.
This is how honest petitioner is, but... Why else were they there?
And why are they asking whether he's engaged in anti-Chinese activities? And it's odd that we're having this conversation today. This, apparently, according to this morning's news, there are policemen on every corner in Beijing because of the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square events. And
certainly some evidence is there, but to point to anything in the record that compels a conclusion contrary to the agency's results, we think that petitioner has failed to meet his burden.
Thank you.
Anything further, Dick? Thank you.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Zhang?
Yes. Just a quick rebuttal, Your Honor. The first denial of the I-130 was not based on the merits. Actually, it's due to the withdrawal by the petitioner.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Where is the persecution in this case? If you're claiming amnesty...
I'm sorry.
What is the nature of the persecution?
Okay.
Which you're claiming amnesty.
As to Falun Gong practitioners, the Chinese government treatment are as diverse from administrative fines, loss of employment, to lengthy prison sentence, to torture. So it all depends on individual circumstances. But in this particular case, the petitioner has been arrested in China due to his practice of Falun Gong. He was detained for one day. He was slapped on the face. And all this evidence go to the well-founded fear issue.
The well-founded fear issue.
Yeah, for the withholding of removal. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.